All right, we're here in Exodus chapter 9, and we are looking at the sixth plague here tonight, the plague of boils. And this is a short section of scripture here dealing with the sixth plague, and we just have three simple points, a pretty basic sermon here tonight. There's a lot of great information here, and let's start here at verse number 8. The Bible reads, "And the Lord said unto Moses and unto Aaron, take to you handfuls of ashes of the furnace, and let Moses sprinkle it toward the heaven in the sight of Pharaoh, and it shall become small dust in all the land of Egypt. And shall be a boil breaking forth with blains upon man and upon beast throughout all the land of Egypt. And they took ashes of the furnace and stood before Pharaoh, and Moses sprinkled it up toward heaven, and it became a boil breaking forth with blains upon man and upon beast." Now, if you're looking for a specific god or goddess that this is an attack on, it is the goddess Isis. And Isis was one of the most famous gods or goddesses in ancient Egypt. And when we're saying Isis, we're not talking about like the Islamic military state in the Middle East, ISIS. What we're talking about is a goddess who was the Egyptian goddess of medicine and peace. And here's what it says about ISIS in more detail. She was the goddess of the moon, protector of women and children, healer of the sick. ISIS was the wife of Osiris and mother of Horus. And I would say Osiris and Horus are two of the most famous Egyptian gods that you probably have heard of before. Her legend eventually found its way to Greece, where temples still stand in devotion to her. Having resurrected her dead husband, so she apparently resurrected her husband from the dead, Isis helped her son to avenge his murder in his battle against Set. She endured as the most important goddess in ancient Egypt until the end of the civilization. The temple of Philae in Aswan was built in her honor, and it was famously relocated from its original location in the 1970s to protect it from flooding caused by the Aswan High Dam. And so I would say this is the main person it's an attack on, because she was the protector of women and children, the healer of the sick. And what we're seeing here with the sixth plague is an attack on the people personally themselves. Whereas the earlier plagues, it was not an ailment upon the people themselves. It was upon the animals, or there was animals filling their land, water to blood, and those things. Now, when we look at these verses that we just read in verses 8 through 10, this is very different than what you're seeing with a lot of the other plagues, because what you see in verses 8 and 9, God says to Moses, this is what you're going to do. And in verse 10, they do it. You do not see a warning given to Pharaoh this time. Because isn't it true when we're looking at all these plagues, it's like, if you don't do this, then this plague is going to be poured out. But in this plague, the sixth plague, there is no warning. There is no indication that there's any warning. God just says, hey, you know what? This is what I want you to do in verses 8 and 9. And then all of a sudden they took ashes to the furnace and stood before Pharaoh, and they just did it. No indication. They said, hey, if you don't let us go, we're going to do this. They just did it. Now, go back to verse number 1 and let's see the comparison. And point number 1 is there is no warning given by God for this plague. There is no warning mentioned by God here in Exodus chapter 9. They just poured out the plague without warning. Exodus 9 verse 1. Then the Lord said unto Moses, go unto Pharaoh and tell him, thus saith the Lord God of the Hebrews, let my people go that they may serve me, for if thou refuse to let them go and wilt hold them still, behold, the hand of the Lord is upon thy cattle which is in the field, upon the horses, upon the asses, upon the camels, upon the oxen, upon the sheep, there shall be a very grievous murrain. So, you know, the fifth plague goes along with like other plagues where basically I want you to go into Pharaoh and tell him, thus saith the Lord, if you do not let my people go, this is what's going to take place. That's exactly what we saw last week. Then it says in verse 4, and the Lord shall sever between the cattle of Israel and the cattle of Egypt, and there shall nothing die of all that is the children's of Israel. And the Lord appointed a set time, saying, tomorrow the Lord shall do this thing in the land. And the Lord did that thing on the morrow, and all the cattle of Egypt died, but of the cattle of the children of Israel died not one. Pharaoh sinned, and behold, there was not one of the cattle of the Israelites dead, and the heart of Pharaoh was hardened, and he did not let the people go. Now, depending on the plagues that we're looking at here, of these 10 plagues, some give more detail than others. It doesn't tell you how long they're talking to Pharaoh. With the fifth plague, which we just read, the one that we covered last week, it specifically says, hey, I want you to go in and give a warning. And then it doesn't really tell us the response of Pharaoh. It just says, okay, now you're going to do this. We can tell from the context, obviously, Pharaoh did not take heed and just said, well, I'm not going to let your people go. But the Bible does not directly tell us that. But what it tells us in the fifth plague, first, I want you to go in and warn. And so that is exactly what they did, right? This is very different, though, than the sixth plague, because there is no indication that they're going in to give any sort of warning or give any sort of speech. Just they go in, and all of a sudden, the next plague comes. Okay? Go to Numbers chapter 14. Numbers 14. And here's what we need to understand in life. God does not always give us warnings. Often, God does give us warnings. Or often, we see certain things in our lives where we realize, you know what, I need to get right with God. I think God's mad at me. Things are not going my way. But don't think that God is obligated to give you a direct warning saying, if you do this, this is going to happen. God might just decide, you know what, you've broken my rules. I'm just going to pour out judgment upon you for what you did. So it is certainly true that God will often give us warnings. And I would say that's his usual pattern, and he's very long-suffering to us. But it's not like he has to do that. And it's not always going to be the case. So every time when you make a decision to commit a sin and willfully go against God, just realize there's no guarantee that afterwards you can just say, I'm sorry. And God's like, well, if you do that again, this is what's going to happen. God might just be like, you know what? No, I'm not giving you a warning. It's just like, it's too much. You broke my rules. You knew what was right. It doesn't matter that you expected a warning. I never said I was going to give you one, right? Now, Numbers is a great example because we're in Numbers 14, and this is after 10 of the 12 spies refused to go to the promised land. And you have Caleb and Joshua who say, let's go. We can win that battle. We can overcome. We talked about maybe a month ago or so about like Caleb being a very man that was very valiant, a man filled full of courage and bravery. And of course, Joshua was a very brave and mighty man in the Bible. But then the other 10 said, we cannot go. And they rile up and energize the crowd to want to kill Joshua and Caleb. And then Moses and Aaron and all of them that are standing up for the things of God. And so they refuse to go in. And then let's see what happens here in Numbers 14, verse 1. And all the congregation lifted up their voice and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron. And the whole congregation said unto them, would God that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would God we had died in this wilderness? Well, I mean, if you're so content to die, if you're so decided to die, then just kill yourself. It's like, would God we had died in the wilderness, then just jump off a cliff. Right? You want to complain, but it's not like it's that hard. I'm sure that you could kill yourself if you wanted to. So they're like, I mean, we wish we had died. It's not, well, then just kill yourself. Right? I mean, if that's what your decision is, just kill yourself then. Verse 3, and wherefore hath the Lord brought us unto this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should be a prey? Were it not better for us to return into Egypt? And they said one to another, let us make a captain and let us return into Egypt. And, you know, as I mentioned here recently, does anybody in their right mind think that they could actually walk back into Egypt? I mean, are you kidding me? It's like, with all the people that died in the Red Sea, and then all of a sudden, you're just going to walk in a little bit later and say, you know what, it was just a misunderstanding. It's like, I know your brother's dead now. I know your mom and dad died. I know all these people died in the flood. You lost your husband. But it was just a mistake. It was just a misunderstanding. You know what? In life, sometimes you make decisions, and there's just no turning back. And honestly, I really feel that way. Like, I don't even think I could possibly go back to my old life, you know, not serving God and just be completely wrapped up in my old career and everything. Because at this point, it's like on my resume, it's like, you know, an evangelist and everything. It's like, I don't think I'd be accepted back in my old life. And for them to think that they're going to walk back into Egypt is insanity. They would be killed right upon entrance. And in fact, given the fact that Egypt was a wicked culture, they would probably have been tortured to death, would be my guess. And I don't know if they're dumb enough to actually think they can return into Egypt, because I would like to think that on the way they would realize, you know what, I don't think they're going to let us back in. So I don't know what they would plan, right? It's kind of like a little kid that says that they're going to run away from mom and dad, like, I hate you, dad. I hate you, mom. I'm running away from home. And then they run outside, and then it's just like, okay, where am I going to go now? What do I do, right? It's like at this point, regardless of if you're upset about what happened, your best place is to be in there with the group of people out there in the wilderness. There's just no turning back at this point. Verse 5, then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation of the children of Israel. Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, which were of them that searched the land, rent their clothes. So they tear their clothes because of course, you know what? They're people filled full of wisdom, and they realize God's wrath is going to come on us. God's going to be angry with us because we did not do what he said. They don't exactly know what's going to take place, but they know that God is going to be very mad at them for what just took place. Verse 39. Go to verse 39. And Moses told these sayings unto all the children of Israel, and the people mourned greatly. And the context is that basically God has decided, you know what? Okay, you're not allowed in the promised land anymore. You're rejected. It's like you had your opportunity. You did not go in. And because you disobeyed, you're going to be disinherited from the land. I'm going to wait for this entire generation to die off, and you are not going to be able to enter the land. You say, what's your point? My point is God didn't really give them a warning about this. They did not expect this. God did not say that if you don't do this, you're going to have to be wandering around for 40 years. You're not going to enter in. No, what took place is they had direct instructions from God. They disobeyed, and God's like, you know what? Okay, you're not allowed in anymore. And of course, then the people are very sad about this. So I go, wait a minute, never mind. Verse 40, and they rose up early in the morning and got them up into the top of the mountain, saying, lo, we be here, and we'll go up unto the place which the Lord hath promised, for we have sinned. They said, we're ready to go now. It's like, we did wrong, we messed up, now we're going to go. And what they think is that God's going to be like, okay, go up, and then we'll let bygones be bygones. You can enter in. I'm going to give you the land. That's not what takes place. Verse 41. And Moses said, wherefore now do ye transgress the commandment of the Lord, but it shall not prosper. Go not up, for the Lord is not among you, that ye be not smitten before your enemies. And Moses says, look, here's the thing. They're going to a land filled full of people that they can logically not defeat. They're bigger than them. Now, they're not like grasshoppers compared to them, like they claim. Like, they're giants, like, you know what, Jack and the Beanstalk or something from the fairy tale. Like, they're 500 feet tall. They're a lot taller than them, though. There's more of them. They've got weapons. They're ready. They're prepared. I mean, I'm sure they've got a defense set up if anyone tries to enter in. I mean, if it were a fight where God is just not involved, then there's no way they would win. Right? It's like, for example, you know, professional sports is entertaining, but I don't think God really cares who wins professional sporting events. So it's kind of like someone's a lot better than the other person. Well, this person's going to win. That's just the way it is. Unless God were to choose to intervene, which I just don't think God would do that for a sporting event. But with this war, basically, God's just kind of like, you know what? I'm not going to help you. The thing is, if God doesn't help, they're not going to win. Because, yes, they could have conquered the land. No, it would not have been a problem because God was with them. And God has the ability to do things through you that you could not do in your own flesh. There's nothing too hard for the Lord. But now that God is not among them, Moses is saying, don't go up. You're going to be smitten. You're going to be killed. You're going to be destroyed. For the Amalekites and the Canaanites are there before you, and ye shall fall by the sword, because you are turned away from the Lord. Therefore, the Lord will not be with you. And so I wouldn't say that God is fighting against them here. I would just say that God's not fighting with them. And the thing is, if God's not fighting with you, then good luck, right? Verse 44, but they presumed to go up onto the hilltop. Nevertheless, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and Moses departed not out of the camp. And Moses is like, I'm not going up. This is what you call a kamikaze mission. Right? I mean, this is a suicide mission. You're going to go up and you're going to be destroyed. You're going to go up and you're going to be killed. You're going to go up and you're going to be smitten and you're going to be defeated. Then the Amalekites came down, the Canaanites which dwelt in that hill, and smote them and discomfited them even unto Hormah. And you say, what's your point? Here's my point. There's no warning given by God about what's going to take place. Because I'll be honest with you. If I lived during this day, I would not have expected this to be what would basically be the last straw where God's like, I'm not letting you enter in. I would not have expected that to be the reaction of God. Now, of course, every reaction of God is correct. But that's not what I would have expected either. And of course, the people didn't expect that. Now, I don't know about Moses and Joshua and Caleb. Maybe they thought that would happen or not. I'm not really sure. But the average person there was not expecting, because they would have never done that if they realized, well, this will be the reaction. And the idea was they're going to complain. They're going to murmur. They're going to try to get their way. What they're trying to do is get the leaders to change their ideas and opinions. And, you know, they do this all throughout the time as they're with them. And, you know, what's the reaction? Well, God's like, you know what? I've dealt with this long enough. Because this is Numbers, right? This is further along. I mean, we've gone through the book of Exodus. And, you know, they got on God's nerves many times when they're complaining and not doing what God said. And then eventually it's just like, okay, you know what? That's it. I'm just taking it away from you. I'm not going to give it to you. Now, he promised them essentially an inheritance if they did what was right. So this would be like you're passing down an inheritance to your son. And then all of a sudden your son does something to make you mad. It's like, all right, never mind. I'm going to give it to somebody else, right? And so basically that generation is going to die off before they get to enter in. But what we're seeing is, God does not really give them a warning. He just says, you know what? I'm not letting you enter in. Go to Exodus chapter 9. Exodus chapter 9. Now, obviously, I'm going to give you this from a human perspective. And obviously, I'm a father. I try to be a good father. But obviously, I'm not God that's a perfect father. And none of us fathers are in this room. None of the mothers in this room are perfect, but we're trying our best. And, you know, here's the thing about this. So obviously this is just an example from my life, but I would just say this, that with my kids, I usually give them a warning. Usually, but not always. Now, sometimes maybe I don't give them a warning because I'm just not in that great of a mood and I lose my temper or whatever, but there's just some times where it's just like, you know what, I feel like I've given you chances in the past. And it's like, you're doing the same thing. It's like, no, there's no warning today. And it's like, but wait a minute. I mean, yesterday I got a warning. Like you said, if you do this then again, then I won't. But it's like, well, I decided not to today. I mean, we don't always, as parents, give warning to our kids. We often do. We often give them that second chance. We often give them the third chance. But, you know, as it's been stated before, God is not the God of infinite chances no matter what. I mean, eventually God will pour out his judgment. Eventually you can make God mad. And I can say as a parent that usually I give my kids warnings, but there are times when my kids do something wrong and I give them no warning and then they just immediately get spanked and they didn't expect it. And then I explain to them, well, this is why you got the spanking. And they expected a warning. They expected a second chance because other times they got that. But that doesn't mean that you're always going to get that. Right? Or sometimes when kids are in trouble, then all of a sudden it's like, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And it's just like, well, it's good you're saying I'm sorry, but it's too late. Sometimes it's like, you know, and look, it's definitely true. Some, when your kids say they're sorry and they mean it, oftentimes you'll go light on them because they, but sometimes they're doing that to get out of trouble, right? Just like all of us did as kids, just like we do as adults also, too. Sometimes we say sorry just because we're trying to get out of whatever, you know, the punishment or problem is going to be or whatever. But what I'm saying is, you know what? Sometimes God gives warnings, but sometimes God does not give warnings, just like with our kids. And what we see, point number one, is this, that God does not give a warning to Pharaoh. And it's like, but wait a minute, God gave warnings at other times. Yeah, but that doesn't mean that every single time Pharaoh, before every single plague, let my people go or this will take place. And so Moses and Aaron just go in and then they just, and then the plague is just poured out upon them. Point number one, we see that there is no warning given to Pharaoh. Point number two, let's see the physical pain upon man. It says here in verse number 11, and the magicians could not stand before Moses because of the boils, for the boil was upon the magicians and upon all the Egyptians. And so this plague specifically is a plague that is very painful upon man. The first plague we saw was the water being turned to blood. Plagues 2 through 4 were with various animals, very disgusting. Plague number 5 is really a financially crushing one with the death of livestock. But plague number 6 is judgment upon the people themselves, where everybody is going to be hit by this, right? Turn your Bible to the book of Job. Turn to the book of Job. Turn to Job chapter 2. And, you know, I'm sure probably everybody here is familiar with the story of Job. And, you know, in Job chapter 1, right off the bat, you see a very righteous person, a very godly person who has been blessed with a big family, and he's a very wealthy man. You know, as we've said, having money does not mean that you're inherently, that there's anything inherently wrong with money. I mean, there's people in the Bible that have a lot of money that are right with God, and Job's a great example. He's a very rich man. He's very right with God, and he did nothing to deserve what took place. He did not have some sort of sin. Now, of course, his friends have the reaction that a lot of people have. If something bad is happening to you, you must have done something wrong. Right? And, you know, I would say this, that when we think about this on an individual level, when things take place in your life, you ought to ask yourself the question in your mind and think about it yourself. But I would caution all of us to have that reaction toward other people when something goes wrong, where something goes wrong in someone's life. Well, I mean, if they went soul winning every week, I don't think this would have happened. It's like you got to be very careful to say certain things like that, because, I mean, if God's and not just the words themselves, but if God sees what you're thinking in your heart, it might be like, okay, well, we'll see. I mean, maybe some random thing's going to happen to you, too, to kind of teach you that, no, that doesn't necessarily mean you did anything wrong. Now, of course, it can. I mean, it is certainly possible that if something bad happens to someone, it's like, well, that is certainly possible that it's the judgment of God or whatever, but it might not be. I would even say this. I think we should be cautious to assume that when something bad happens to someone who's not a godly person, like an unsaved person or a bad person, I think we should also be cautious just to say, well, you know what? That's the judgment of God. It's like, well, I mean, you don't necessarily know that. I mean, the Bible tells us specific examples, but you know, the truth is this. There's a lot of ungodly people that live long lives. And so it's like they don't always have something come down on them. And so obviously it's possible. And when things happen to wicked people, you could oftentimes sort of see the fingerprints where maybe, you know, they're being judged for something. But I just think we should be cautious because we don't really know what God's doing, right? We should certainly be cautious, though, when something happens to someone that is a saved person and not have this attitude, well, I mean, it's because of this, right? We have no idea. That's the reaction his friends have, and unfortunately, that's the normal reaction that we have as people that we got to fight against. But in Job chapter 1, what takes place is he loses all of his children, he loses his money, and if you remember as I preached through this recently, I showed you that when you really look at that story, it's like one person's talking, and he's not even done talking, and then all of a sudden the next one comes, and the next one comes, where basically Job has not even had time to process all of this information. But nothing has happened to the physical flesh of Job by the end of Job chapter 1. He is physically fine. His kids are dead. He's lost his money. I mean, he's struggling. Obviously, he doesn't understand and all of these things. But nothing has actually happened to his flesh. So basically, what the devil tries to do doesn't work. Because he's trying to get Job to curse God. It does not work. And then the devil has a backup plan. Where the devil's like, you know what? What I'm going to do is I'm going to harm him personally. And that is going to cause him to end up cursing God. And notice what it says here in Job 2, verse 1. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. Now, I do want to say this on a side point, and this would not be the main verse I would use, nor would Job 1 be the main verse that I would use. But Job 2, verse 1 disproves the idea that the sons of God are fallen angels. And the reason why it disproves that is because if fallen angels are a son of God, then Satan is a son of God, right? Well, here's the thing. Notice what it says in verse 1. Again, there was, and they never mention that. It's like they don't want to say that Satan's the son of God. They'll let all the other fallen angels be sons of God. They'll never say that. Well, of course, then Satan would be a son of God also, if that's what you believe. But notice what it says in verse 1. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Doesn't tell us the sons of God, who they are here, just the sons of God, okay? And notice this, and Satan came also among them. It does not say, and Satan was one of them. He came also, meaning in addition, meaning he is not one of the sons of God. He came also among them, and that's the same wording in Job chapter 1. And so people like to go to the book of Job at the end, and they use one verse to try to overhaul everything the Bible says about sons of God being people that believe on the Lord and are saved. And then they'll say, well, look at the end of Job. Well, let's just go at the beginning of Job. Because, and you know what? I made a short video about this like 4 or 5 years ago on our channel, and it has a lot of views because people are like obsessed with this topic. And then like people criticize, like, you're being too like specific on the wording or too. That's exactly what that word means also. It means in addition. It means he's not one of them. The way the Bible would have worded it is, and Satan was one of them. But it says he came also. So the sons of God came, and guess who also came? Meaning he's not one of them, and that is Satan. You say, well, who are the sons of God then? They're people that believed on the Lord. You say, well, how are they presenting themselves before the Lord? Because people in the Old Testament went to heaven. Okay, I don't have time to go into all these topics, but say people were in heaven in the Old Testament. Just as you see Elijah going up, Elijah's not just hanging out in the sky here today. It's like, you know, you're out, you know, you're wanting to look at the stars and everything and look at the planets, you're out. Like, I spotted Elijah. He's up there. I see him hanging out there. That's who the man on the moon is, right? It's like, no, he went to heaven, okay? And the sons of God are presenting themselves before the Lord. Of course, I don't really know what the sons of God are, you know, whether or not this is a daily thing, a weekly thing, or whatever. God just wanted to speak to them. Maybe he's just talking to them about the word of God, teaching them more. I have no idea. These are people that believed on the Lord that lived, you know, in the past. And then Satan also came amongst these people that actually believe on the Lord, people that died to save people, and he also comes to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said unto Satan, from whence comest thou? And Satan answered the Lord. And, you know, this is funny when you really break down what's being said, because Satan's the same thing in Job 1. Satan specifically goes to bring up Job. And God brings him up first. This is exactly what Satan wants to bring up. And notice what God says to Satan, from whence comest thou? Where'd you come from? And Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro in the earth and from walking up and down in it. It's interesting because of the fact we really see the power of God here in this short conversation when you stop and think about it. Because what we see is that Satan is going to and fro in the earth. It's like, well, that's interesting because God's everywhere. He doesn't have to travel. He's everywhere. Right, we see the omnipresence of God, the fact that Satan cannot be everywhere at once. We see this distinction, whereas God doesn't have to go to and fro in the earth. Right, he's everywhere. And the Lord said unto Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job? What do we see there? We see the omniscience of God, because that is exactly what the devil wanted to talk about. So we see the omnipresence of God, that he's everywhere. We see the omniscience of God. You know, you also see in this story, in this conversation, the omnipotence of God, the fact that he's all powerful, because he says, I'll let you do this, Satan, but you can't do this. So in this short conversation, we see the omniscience of God, the omnipresence of God, and the fact that God is omnipotent as well, which are kind of the three characteristics, probably the three main ones you think of that the average person would think of. Tell us what God is like. All powerful, everywhere, and he knows everything, right? All of that is described here in these verses, in this conversation between God and the devil. And the Lord said unto Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil, and still he holdeth fast his integrity, although thou movest me against him to destroy him without cause. Verse 4. And Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin, yea, all that a man hath will he give for his life. But put forth thy hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse thee to thy face. And the Lord said unto Satan, behold, he is in thine hand, but save his life. And so when God says, I'll let you do that, but save his life, we're saying that God is all powerful because he can stop it if he wants. So went Satan forth from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot unto his crown. And he took him a potsherd to scrape himself withal. He sat down among the ashes. Now, I used to be kind of confused about this story because when I read all the things that happened to Job, I just thought that, you know, the punishment that the devil gives to Job in chapter 2 is nowhere near as bad as chapter 1. Right? I mean, wouldn't it be far worse to lose your children than to be struck with an ailment that's eventually going to go away? Even the money. I mean, because if this was permanent, that would be a different thing, right? Because obviously, you know, all of us, I'm sure we all value our health. I would value my health more than wealth. But here's the thing. This isn't forever. But yet, Satan is very confident that Job is going to curse God to his face, and it kind of confused me. But I think this is the reason why. Because Satan is thinking the way that he is going to be the way that Job is. And for someone that's completely self-centered and only cares about himself, he probably thinks, you know what, if his skin is cursed, he'll curse God. When in reality, someone who loves his kids, and we saw that in Job chapter 1 as he's making offering for them, it's like that is far worse than having your own skin cursed and having an ailment and health problems. I mean, it's far worse. I mean, it's not even close. This is not really something I thought about before I had children, but being married with children now, it's just like the punishment is far worse in Job 1 than Job chapter 2. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because one thing that really made me think about this is actually Richard Dawkins, who I've been talking about a lot on the series on Saturdays, because when I read his book, I was just amazed. And I'll talk about it more on Saturday because it's going to be the sermon on creation versus evolution. But literally Richard Dawkins' view of how evolution works, the mechanism that he thinks, it's called the selfish gene, the quintessential book on evolutionary biology, because he says that inside of all of us, we are all 100% evil and selfish and only care about ourselves. And anything good we ever do is only because we're going to get something out of it. And it's like you're describing a reprobate, Richard Dawkins. Why is it that the mechanism that you came up with that became very famous, that a lot of evolutionists that are really into this stuff are all for, you're literally just describing a reprobate? And it's just like, well, I mean, if that's what's on the inside of your heart and your mind, that's what the way you're going to think of it. Like, well, everybody must be like this. This is the way we are. No, that's just you, Richard Dawkins. And here's the thing I think with this. I think that's the way it is with Satan, where he just kind of thinks, while everybody cares about themselves, it's like, well, that's the way you are, Satan. That's not the way everybody is, though. And I'm not saying that what took place in Job 2 is not a big deal at all. I mean, obviously, this is horrible what took place, and obviously the pain. And it describes it as being extremely serious to the point where it's far worse than anything I've had happen physically. But it's not as bad as Job chapter 1. And I think the reason why Satan comes up with this plan is, you know, he just figures that, wow, you know, everybody's like this. No, that's just you, Satan. Go to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians 5. So when it comes to boils and blains, let me just give you the definition of this. A blain is an inflamed swelling on the skin. A boil is an inflamed, pus-filled swelling on the skin caused typically by the infection of a hair follicle. And, you know, I don't think this is the exact same thing, you know, but blisters can be very painful also. And I've had times where I've had, especially I used to do a lot of running, and every once in a while you get new shoes and you get big blisters, and then it hurts to even walk in them, or it's very sensitive, especially on the heel. Or if you get a new pair of dress shoes, right? I switched a long time ago to the comfortable dress shoes. Because, you know, the old-fashioned ones, it's like you put your foot in there and then, like, the next day at the back of your heel, you've got, like, this massive, like, blister that, I mean, they're hard as a rock. It's like a weapon. I don't know who invented the normal dress shoes, but it's like, you know what, I heard this a long time ago from someone. They said, well, you know, I go out soul winning, so it's like I don't want to wear out my feet. It's like, yeah, that's what I do. I have the comfortable, somewhat dress shoe now because it's just far more practical. But blisters can be extremely painful to the point where it's just like, you know, you can't really walk around much or trying to avoid it. You know, everywhere you step, it's really painful. And, you know, obviously this is worse than that, but it's kind of the best way I can think about it. But it says here in Ephesians 5, verse 25, husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So have men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. Now, when it comes to our own flesh, we naturally care about our flesh, the things that we want, right? Before a person's married, they care about themselves primarily. I mean, before you're married, you have the freedom to go out and do whatever you want. You have the freedom to go out and I want to just go to this restaurant. I don't have to tell anybody about it. I don't have any rules or anything like that. But, you know, it's obviously different when you're married. It's like I would never recommend to any husbands or wives to just, you know, leave the house and just don't even tell your spouse what you're doing. It's just like, you know, well, I mean, I wish I had known about this, right, or whatever. It's like, you know, when I was single, though, sometimes it would be like late at night. It's like, you know what, I feel like going to the gym. It's like 11 o'clock at night. I don't feel like sleeping. Let me just go to the gym, and then I come back. I take a shower. But I don't leave the house, you know, at like 11 o'clock at night. You say, why? Because I have a family and kids. And, you know, when you get married and you have a family, especially when you have kids, it really teaches you that your life's not about you. And, you know, you hear these things preached. And, you know, I heard preaching like this a long time before I was married, before I had a family. And you kind of understand it. You hear it. It makes sense. But it's completely different when you're actually married and you have kids and you have a family. It's just completely